Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. There are murders and there are murders. There are bodies and there are bodies, and then there's what lies waiting behind the front door of the little brick house with its blinds drawn and air conditioner droning on, working against the oppressive Hunter Valley heat. A glimpse into the dark cockroach corners of the soul. A lot of the blokes at the scene that day will never be the same. On February 29, 2000, Catherine Knight committed an unspeakable act. A mother of four and a grandmother, she seduced and then stabbed John Price 37 times. A former abattoir worker, she skinned him. A loving partner, she cooked him with vegetables, making a soup with his head. Made gravy, left him on plates for his family. Why? Pricey was her de facto, and he wanted out. She didn't like that. People said that most of the time Catherine Knight seemed normal. Until she got angry, she was judged to be legally sane when she committed a crime so horrible that the media shied away from the detail. Journalist Peter Lehler covered the trial and wanted to know what made Knight go way over the borderline. In this unflinching account, he uncovers the layers of her dysfunction, opening the door of 84 St. Andrew Street and taking us into the lives of Knight's ex-partners, her family, and the locals of Aberdeen, North South Wales. Catherine Knight is currently the only woman serving a life sentence in Australia. She is never to be released. Bloodstain, the true story of Catherine Knight, the mother and abattoir worker who became Australia's worst female killer. With my special guest, journalist and author, Peter Lehler. Welcome to the program and thank you for agreeing to this interview. Peter Lehler.
Hi, Dan.
Good evening, Peter. Thank you very much for joining me all the way from Australia. Thank you.
Thank you.
We have an incredible tale here, and it's highly anticipated, and somehow or other I didn't know of this storytelling recently, thanks to one of the fans of True Murder, brought to my attention this incredible story and your wonderful book. First question, tell us the circumstances in which you came to want to and became the author of this book, Bloodstain. What brought you to this story?
Yeah, well, I was a reluctant author, I must admit. I was a journalist at the time working for the newspaper in Sydney, which is known as the Daily Telegraph. It's quite a large tabloid newspaper. I was a feature writer, and I was sent to Newcastle, which is a town to the north of Sydney, a sort of coal mining industrial town, to cover Catherine Knight's sentencing hearing. Up until that point, very few people knew much about this crime, a little bit like you in a way, because of a sort of series of circumstances, it actually hadn't been in the media. One good reason was she was charged with murder immediately and the details were suppressed. But one of the local newspapers up on the New England Highway reported some of the details, and there was public outrage that such things would be in a newspaper. And I think that everybody got a little bit squeamish about it. So I went up there, covered the sentencing, wrote some pieces for the newspaper, and got a phone call from a publishing house who said, "Would you like to write a book about it?" And my initial response was, "Who on earth would want to read that stuff? It is just so awful." They chuckled a little and said, "Well, you know, we really want to write a book that explores Catherine's life and how she got to that point." I said, "Oh, well, that sounds all right. I'll give that a shot." And but here we are, 14 years later, still talking about this book. It doesn't go away.
Absolutely. Why don't you take us back as you do and talk about a little bit about Catherine Knight and her parents, Ken and Barbara. Just tell us a little bit about who these people are, and as we talk about and we unfold the story of the upbringing of Catherine Knight.
Well, these were people from what we call what's known as the Hunter Valley. It's a very interesting area about 2 hours' drive north of Sydney. On one side of the road, you go off into the hills. There's beautiful wineries, estates, golf courses. You know, it's the playground of the rich. Australia's richest man, Kerry Packer, had a polo farm up there. But on the other side of the highway, it is coal mines, hard industry, and a series of abattoirs up and down the small towns. In the past, that industry has died. Catherine's parents were from that area. They were abattoir workers. They were rough people, very rough people. Barb and Ken got together in very interesting circumstances. She left her husband and ran away with him. They followed work around the abattoirs up and down the highway, had a number of children. I think there were 6 children, but they were spread around a little bit. She didn't take her first 2 children with her when she hooked up with her new husband. She had twins with him. Catherine's a twin. Her sister's name is Joy. And they settled into a little town called Aberdeen, which is between Musselbrook and Scone. It's a pretty rough little town. Highway runs right through the middle of it. It has 2 pubs. In Australia, we always call them the top pub and the bottom pub. And they had a painful and unfortunate life. They were hunters, fringe dwellers, uneducated people, very rough people, hard-drinking people. Catherine grew up in an environment of terrible violence. Sexual violence was a norm in the home. If not a norm, it wasn't uncommon. And she became a very disturbed little girl. In fact, the psychiatrists think that she possibly just developed stress disorder from being sexually assaulted as a child, and that was within the family.
When you talk about sexual violence, I want to get to the uniqueness of what you're talking about after reading, you know, numbers of these books. When we're talking about the sexual violence, what did Catherine and Joy and the rest of the family get to see on a regular basis in terms of the sexual promiscuity between her parents? What did that encompass?
Well, it's almost impossible to believe. I still struggle to deal with this, but Catherine gave this account of her life, and it wasn't contradicted by her siblings either. That if, as he did regularly, he wasn't a man to send his wife to the law. He demanded it, and he would quite often rape in front of the children. And in fact, on one occasion, I've heard about, he knocked her out and raped her on the kitchen table with the children in the house. So it was a level of depravity that's hard to fathom, really. Absolutely hard to fathom. And I think that's perhaps what makes Catherine and her life so fascinating. I think we all live our lives thinking that, you know, most people are relatively normal. They don't stray too far from what's acceptable. We think that mad people commit violent crimes. We don't imagine that there are lives out there like that. We don't imagine what sort of a life Catherine knew as normal. I mean, that was, to her, what a family was, a place where your father raped your mother, where your stepbrothers sexually assaulted you as a child. She knew very early in her life that sex and violence were connected. They went hand in hand. You didn't have one without the other.
Now, when we talk about the abattoir and the kind of employment that this family had, and everybody worked in the Knight family in the abattoir, what is it exactly about job that these people excelled at? Why was it that this family was so noted, I guess, being able to handle this job? What was it about them that made them good workers at the abattoir?
Well, I think you find in India, don't you, that the lowest castes are the castes that work with animals in slaughterhouses. And I think in a similar way here, the people that end up in abattoirs are pretty struggling to get a job anywhere else. I mean, there was good employment in those areas in the coal mines, and it paid very well. But if you couldn't get a job in a coal mine, if you didn't have a proper education, you ended up in these places, which are terribly brutal places. And you'll find that there are two types of people that work in abattoirs when you talk to abattoir workers. There are those that endure it, that put up with it. It's not a pleasant environment in any way. No. But then there's a very small group of people who actually enjoy their work. They disturb everybody. They are people who have an asterisk next to them. And Catherine was one of these people. Catherine aspired all her life to work in the abattoir. She wanted to kill animals. She talked about nicking the veins in their necks to watch them bleed out. She spoke about her joy of, you know, of removing the bones out of the flesh. She had a perverse fascination with dying animals and with dead animals and with the products of dead animals. She also, unfortunately, had a fascination with her knives. She was very skilled with her knives. Abattoir workers have very sharp, lethal knives. Catherine loved her. She ended up losing the job in the abattoir because she got injured, and she ended up on welfare. And you can in Australia live a reasonable life on welfare if you have enough children, which she manufactured. So she was a little bit disappointed about that. But the interesting thing was she kept her knives. And not only did she keep her knives, much to the horror of her first husband, David Callett, she actually kept them above the bed on the wall.
Right.
As almost a threat to the men that came in there. And she was a woman of particular violence toward men, as all of her partners discovered and as all of her partners told me when I was researching this book.
Now, you, in that researching for this book, you speak to many of her ex-partners at great length, and of course, they're very cooperative. You have incredible access to them. So let's talk about some of her behavior leading up to meeting David Kellett and the kind of people that she did meet and what they said about her behavior, and at the same time, what she characterized the relationship as in terms of the behavior.
I suppose hindsight's a wonderful thing, but there were signs very early on that Catherine was going to be a significant problem. She was a violent child at school. She had violent tantrums. And when she was very young, she hooked up with David Callett. He was a very small man, and she's a very big, strong woman. She could knock a man out with a punch. You know, she was very good splitting logs with an axe. She was an intimidating woman. David learnt very early on in their relationship that she had certain demands, and unless they were met, she responded with violence. Before he agreed to marry her, it was an alcohol-soaked wedding. He was so drunk that I think he could barely stand at the ceremony. She drove him there on the back of her motorbike. She actually picked him up from somewhere where he was drinking and forced him to come along and marry her. Her mother said to him, took him aside and said, "You need to be very, very careful with a person like my daughter. Never, ever upset her. Never cheat on her, because she will kill you." David took it in his stride. He thought she was a bit fiery. But then on the first night of their wedding, they were very young, they were teenagers, they consummated the marriage, and they consummated and they had sex a couple of times, David told me, and then he fell asleep because he'd been drinking all day, and that's what men do, isn't it? The next thing he knew, she had him pinned to the bed with a knife in her hand, and she was in a state of apoplexy. She was screaming at him, and she said, my mother told me that on her wedding night, they had sex 7 times. And she was in this state of fury because he'd let her down and they'd only ever had sex twice. And she was holding a knife to his throat. I mean, he actually thought he was going to be killed on his wedding night for not performing in bed, which almost sounds like a black comedy, doesn't it? But the poor guy was scared out of his wits. It was very interesting that the former partners were keen to talk to me because these are tough guys. I mean, we're talking coal miners, abattoir workers, truck drivers, hard-drinking Australian men from small towns, you know, poorly educated, tough blokes. But when I tracked them all down, they all had stories to tell of terrible domestic violence perpetrated against them. Two of them wept as they told me stories of what Catherine had done to her. It's a very disconcerting experience to sit across from a tough Aussie bloke crying as he tells you how brutal his wife was to him. I mean, to a degree, it's unbelievable. It doesn't add up, doesn't fit into your realm of experience. And in fact, in many ways, that's how she got away with it most of her life, because nobody would ever believe those men when they told their stories. But they wanted to tell their stories. They were very keen to take me aside and say, look, this is what I went through. And to a man, they all felt terrible sympathy for the partner that she murdered, because I think they all saw themselves at one time or another that could have been them. But they ducked that bullet as such.
Let's talk about, for a great example of not only this violence exhibited towards men, her boyfriends. Again, you talk about the paranoia and fear of rejection. And, of course, why not? They have children. And so in 1976, in August, you talk about a particular incident, very, very strange. Tell us about Melissa and August 1976.
Yes, well, this is David Callett didn't heed the warning from Catherine's mother and was having an affair with another woman in town. And Catherine was starting to become aware of this. David realized that the only way he was going to get away with this was to leave town. And he left town with another woman and took off up the highway. Any woman... they had a young child. I think Melissa wasn't even 1 year old at the time. Catherine was distraught, as any young mother would be in that situation. Her partner had left her, and she'd been left holding the baby, literally. But her response was so over the top that it defies the imagination. She was seen walking down the main street of the town with pushing the baby in the pram, howling uncontrollably, and swinging the pram from one side of the street to the other. Everybody in Aberdeen was frightened of Catherine Knight, frightened of the Knights, but particularly Catherine Knight. And they just got out of her way, and Catherine disappeared. Nobody, I don't think anyone stuck their nose in it, because I don't think anyone wanted the consequences of intruding. Catherine took the baby and placed the baby on the railway tracks, which it's the coal train runs through Aberdeen, and it's down a siding. Nobody goes there usually. And she left, and her clear intention was for the baby to be run over by the coal train. Fortunately for Melissa, two veteran who was a little bit of a hobo lived outside the town in a makeshift shack. He was wandering along the train tracks that day and found a baby before the train arrived. Some people say that the train was minutes away. I've never been able to confirm that. So he rescued the baby. In the meantime, Catherine was insane with grief and rage, and was picked up by the police, and they took her to a psychiatric institution overnight. I spoke to the policeman's wife about the situation. She said she felt terribly sorry for this girl, but her behavior was vile. Her language and her aggression were off the scale. Somehow she checked herself out of the psychiatric institution and came back to town the following day. And she resolved to have her revenge on her husband who'd left her. So she went to the local... First of all, she wandered into a house of a girl she went to school with a knife. She took the elderly mother, the teenage daughter, and the young son hostage, put them in a car and said, "You will drive me to Queensland, where my husband is, up over the border, and I'm going to kill him." They were petrified, naturally. At one point, the teenage daughter tried to run away. Catherine chased her and threw her to the ground in the front yard and nicked her, and very sort of deliberately nicked her face with one of these knives that are so sharp, and said, "Get back into the house." Before she went up the highway, they stopped the car at a service station. There's some dispute about this, but Catherine says that she decided that she was going to kill the mechanic at the service station, the local service station, because the mechanic had fixed her husband's car that he'd used to get away from her. So he was involved in this betrayal. The hostage situation sort of escalated quite quickly there, and in the end, the police arrived, fortunately, because the young boy escaped and managed to alert the police in town. She was arrested again, taken back to a psychiatric institution and committed. Strangely enough, David felt very sorry for her when he heard what had happened, and along with his mother. Some weeks later, drove down to this psychiatric institution and checked her out, and they recommenced their married life. With all of the partners, you find that the violence or the excess of Catherine, they have some sympathy with her and for her, and they return after acts of violence. Khaled just said he felt sorry for her. He felt guilty. He felt sorry, so he took her back.
Part of this taking back is that she is great at making things up to her partners, isn't she? And she is very, I guess, sexually a dynamic partner to these people, isn't she?
Yes. I have to be a little hesitant about the way that repeating what the men said to me. Because I did, I asked Saunders, the second partner, and Callett, the first, why they went back. The sex was fantastic, was the basic answer. And she could be a caring, devoted, loving person. What's going on here is she has borderline personality disorder. I'm not sure if all of your listeners would be familiar with that. It's in the DSM. It doesn't sound like a serious disorder, but believe me, it is. It's very difficult to treat, and it makes your life very problematic if you have it. It's often a reaction to post-traumatic stress, early trauma, early in your life. She had post-traumatic stress disorder too, they think. What happens is you have this absolute fear of separation, of somebody leaving you, of somebody betraying you, and you will react you will react with extraordinary emotion to the slightest insult. Insults being things like failing to ring on time, or come home on time, or perhaps talking to another woman in the pub. That's an act of betrayal. That in Catherine, she responds like most people with borderline personality disorder are upset by this, but Catherine responds with violence. Another element of borderline personality disorder is that they will fix on their partner and they will love their partner with a similar sort of extreme passion. They are very, very loving partners. They will do everything for you. You know, Catherine cooked, cleaned, washed. She was the perfect sort of housewife in a way, a perfect partner if you overlook the violence.
Now, the other characteristics of these relationships are that she does things like accuses all of her partners, but she accuses David Kellett of cheating on her. But at the same time, it's ironic that she's also accused of cheating by Dave. So tell us the real information on whether, and what from your research, whether what the real situation was in terms of infidelity by both partners.
Yeah, so David, God rest his soul, because he's dead now, he was not a faithful partner. He had a number of affairs. He had an affair with the girl next door and almost got caught because, unbelievably, she left her bra in Catherine's bed, and David somehow came up with a story to excuse that away. But naturally, he was under suspicion all the time, and for quite good reason. Catherine is not prone to that sort of behaviour, that sort of indiscriminate sort of sexual partners, indiscriminate cheating. What she will do and what people with borderline personality disorder are prone to do is swap trains. They will be absolutely in love with somebody up until a point. They will meet somebody else and then they transfer all of their affection and emotion to the next person. It's as if the last person didn't exist. And they transfer totally. Catherine did that a number of times as she moved from one partner to another through her life. And, yes, she ended up taking... Well, she left David. I don't think she was having an affair at the time, but very soon after... It's actually hard to pin down the timeline on that. Very soon after, she'd taken up with another bloke, another very hard-drinking... man who worked as a mechanic in the coal mines up in the next town, a chap by the name of David Saunders. Like Kellett, very friendly, likeable, knockabout Aussie bloke. Also, like Kellett, Saunders has died since. Catherine sort of has tended to outlive almost all of her partners. Almost all the men in this story are dead or not in a very good state because of their exposure to her.
Before we get to Catherine's next partner, David Saunders, we just alluded to and introduced him, we're going to take a break just for 2 minutes to talk about Pro Flowers and their incredible offer for this weekend, Mother's Day. Mother's Day is this weekend. It's only 5 days away. And my mother has always been an expert on everything, cooking, relationship advice, fixing my cuts and bruises. I still go to my mother on advice on which three cheeses she exactly uses for her famous lasagna. But the one thing I don't go to her advice for, and you can't either, is what to get her for Mother's Day. But not to worry, you'll look like an expert on Mother's Day when you use Pro Flowers. Their offer is get Mom 100 blooms. That's 100 blooms with a free glass vase for $19.99, plus shipping and handling. Or make her day extra special, upgrade to a premium vase, and add gourmet chocolates for just $9.99 more. Go to ProFlowers, that's ProFlowers.com today, and use my code TRUEMURDER. Now, ProFlowers takes the guesswork out of sending mom, grandma, or your wife the perfect Mother's Day gift. ProFlowers are guaranteed to be fresh and beautiful for at least 7 days or your money back. For my mother's birthday in January, Pearl Flowers delivered her a fantastic-looking arrangement with a beautiful vase. She loved it, and when her neighbor saw the flowers, she ordered flowers and chocolates that same day for herself. And my mother told me that the flowers look great many days after the week that Pearl Flowers promised. Now, here's the only way to get 100 blooms with a free glass vase starting at only $19.99. Visit proflowers.com, click the blue microphone in the top right corner, and type in True Murder, one word. That's proflowers.com. Click on the microphone and type in True Murder. Remember, Mother's Day is this weekend, so order today. And time is running out. This offer expires Friday at midnight. That's proflowers.com. Now, Peter, we introduced David Saunders, her next partner. You talked about him being a hard drinker, also another small-town tough guy. Tell us what the differences were with David Saunders, despite, among other things, his stature. But tell us the differences with David Saunders and this relationship.
I suppose just before I answer your question, Mother's Day reminded me of something that I think was quite important that involved when Callett picked Catherine up from the asylum to take her back. He was with his mother, and they had Catherine in the car, and they stopped at Catherine's parents' house to pick up some things because they were going to go to live with Callett's mother for a little while. When they got there, they pulled up the car and there was an incident, and Catherine's mother saw Callett in the car and came running out of the house, and he was grabbed him. He was in the passenger seat and tried to swaddle him, tried to actually choke him for leaving her daughter, and she wouldn't let go. Catherine got out of the back seat of the car, told her to stop. She didn't stop, and knocked her mother out with a single punch. Bizarre scenes, absolutely bizarre scenes. Callett's mother, who was from a very nice lady from a nice background, sat there and had never seen anything like it in her life. She was in the car too. They couldn't get away from there quick enough. But there was just a little slice of life from the things. Saunders was, like Callett, a hard-drinking man. He loved. He was a little bit taller, so not as physically intimidated by Catherine. Callett got out of the relationship reasonably lightly. He had his skull fractured by a frying pan for having come home too late from the pub one night. Saunders had a bad habit of coming home from the pub later than he said he would. Catherine's anxiety about separation would kick in. One night he came in the front door of her house with a six-pack of beer under one hand, and he opened the door with the other hand to see Catherine standing there, and she had been ironing the clothes at that point. And she greeted him with the iron in hand and punched him in the face with the iron as he walked through the door. He told me that he had burn marks with steam holes down the side of his face from the greeting from Catherine, all because he was 50 minutes late from the pub, which was about two blocks away. He had another terrible incident where she suspected he was cheating on her. She got it into her head that he was seeing another woman. I think he was. She told him that she'd had enough, and she was going to show him what would happen to him if she caught him cheating. And she walked out the back of the house. He wasn't quite sure what she was doing. He followed her out the back and looked out. Was it dark? And he had a dingo pup. I don't know if you know dingoes. They're a native Australian dog, a beautiful dog. He had a dingo pup, and she was holding it in her arms, and he couldn't quite understand why, because she had no affection at all for animals, Catherine. In fact, there are stories of her swerving the car as they drove to hit cats and dogs. He looked more closely, and Catherine had slit the dog's throat with a kitchen knife as a warning to Saunders what would happen to him should he ever cheat on her. Another time, one of his mates told me that he fronted up to their house to get a lift to work that morning and said, "Look, mate, before we go, you've got to help me out. Have you got a needle and thread?" And the guy said, "Why are you torn your clothes? What does it matter? You know, we work in a mine." No, and opened his shirt, and Catherine had stabbed him in the chest. He didn't want to go to the hospital, so he got his mate to sew him up there, and they went to work that day.
One of the characteristics of Catherine is to sort of impede any kind of investigation or any potential charge. When she assaults her mate, she actually goes to police with a story in advance to try to cover any kind of potential charges, doesn't she? She's quite clever in that way.
Oh, very clever, very clever. And in fact, this has very unfortunate consequences when she does kill her partner. She will run immediately to the police and allege that she is the victim of a domestic violence assault. That happened after she killed the pup. She ran to the police and said that she was in fear of her life, that he chased her around. It happened every time there was a serious incident. What policeman is ever going to believe that these men are being assaulted by their women, even if they do try and say that? You know, they just haven't got a hope of being believed. I mean, it is natural for the police to think, well, we need to protect the woman, not the man, because that's the way these things work. It was also a reflection of the fact that she's a victim. She had constructed a life for herself where she is the victim of men. It dates back in some ways to being a victim of sexual violence as a child. She alleges that her stepbrother sexually abused her. He's never denied it. I wrote it in the book, and he had every chance to deny it, but he didn't. So she often spoke about men getting their way with her, and how she had to protect herself and protect her children from the sexual violence of men. I actually think she believed it. I don't think she was cynical about these things. If she assaulted them, she had a very good reason to assault them, and she ran to the police and she got protected on every occasion. Only once, I think, was there a question of pressing charges against her, and that was when she had caved in Callett's skull with a skillet. She'd actually fractured his skull and he was in hospital. The police attended and said, we think you should press charges against her. He decided not to do it. But that was the one time in a long history of violence where perhaps the law got the right end of the tail.
Now, she always used this idea that when you say that she believed it, but she did accuse all her partners of, or most of them, of sexual abuse of her children.
That was an emerging theme. She certainly accused Price, who was the man that she murdered, of sexually abusing her children, and she did use that as a tactic. She never accused, from memory, she never accused Callett of this or Saunders. She was reasonably fond of those, but as she became more desperate in her life, she did try those things, and she was increasingly desperate in the lead up to the crime, and was accusing Price of sexual assault of her children. She was hyper vigilant around her children. I mean, she was terribly, terribly rough with them in the way she spoke to them and treated them. The neighbours shuddered in horror at the things that she heard them saying to her children. She was a very stern and stern mother. But in her head, as I said earlier, they were all potential victims of sexual violence. I don't think at any stage were any of her children sexually abused. Certainly, there's no suggestion that Price had, as she accused him, sexually abused the youngest one. She did leave a note when she killed him alleging that, but there's no proof of that. There's no suggestion from anybody that that happened.
You mentioned the thing that happens that people notice when Catherine becomes unhinged. What is the physical characteristic that people notice when she does lose her grip?
Well, and this is a terrible cliche, but she's a red-headed woman with freckles. She was dubbed the Speckled Hen by her last partner. She would become very red. She would flush with anger and become completely irrational with the violence. You could not go near her. If you did, you were in trouble. It was probably the only sights. Fortunately, I've never seen her angry. The guys that did see her angry, as I said, sometimes they wept as they described these rages that she was in. But obviously she would calm down very quickly too, to actually assemble a story and get to the police and, you know, cover her tracks as she always did.
Yeah, as you write in the book too, that these partners left in this world of chaos, but somehow or other, she, in better times, convinced them that everything was okay. So she had at least a couple times where the people left, and you would think, geez, there's no way that he's coming back. And he did come back. These partners came back, didn't they?
Yeah. And that's the thing that I needed to tease out in the book, and I'm not sure if I did it successfully or not, because it still baffles me, to be honest with you. And it was the thing that first struck me when I walked into the courtroom and saw her. We believe that somebody who commits a crime like Catherine did, he's basically a Hannibal Lecter type. We want to think that they're insane, that they're an animal, and that, you know, they're going to be trussed up. But you walked into the courtroom, she was quite an ordinary looking woman. She wore a nice frock, her hair was done, she had a crucifix that she wore around her neck. You wouldn't have thought twice if you walked past her in the street. She could have passed herself off as a librarian. You know, she was a very ordinary looking person. And what's difficult for us to actually get our heads around is that somebody who could raise four children, own their own home, live a reasonably normal life, if we excise the violence, somebody who operated among us, looked like us, perhaps was rougher than most of us, and had some edge about her that unnerved you, but that somebody could commit a crime like she did, that's what's astounding. And that she could have, as you say, she had three partners, she had four children with those three partners. They kept coming back, these guys. I mean, the third partner, who we haven't discussed yet, Chillingworth, he was very distressed when she left him. He felt like he was driving up and down the highway. He actually became unhinged from the separation. So we're not talking about a monster. We're talking about somebody who managed to get by in an ordinary life and managed to make men love her, because they did love her.
Let's talk about, you mentioned John Chillingworth. Tell us what was different about that relationship before we talk about the most important relationship is with John Pricey. So what was it about John Chillingworth that was different than the other relationships, and how does it lead to having Catherine with John Price?
Well, I think one interesting part of the segue from Saunders to Chillingworth is that they have a daughter together, Saunders and Catherine. And again, she jumps trains. She disappears. She takes off. He doesn't know where she's gone. He also disappears. He leaves town because he doesn't want her finding him. And it's a strange sort of standoff. But what she does is she tells their daughter that her father is dead, that he's died. And there's a very strange scene when Catherine's driving the daughter through Musselbrook one day, and they stop at the light, and the daughter starts to yell from the back of the car, "Daddy's not dead, Mummy. There he is, there he is." And there was her father walking along the street, the father that she thought was dead. I mean, what sort of cruelty does a woman have to tell a child that, sure. that her father's dead when in fact he isn't? But he was certainly dead to Catherine. She was sick of him and she'd moved on. She'd moved on to Chillingworth. Chillingworth had very serious drinking problem, had when I met him and interviewed him for the books. He'd joined Alcoholics Anonymous and hadn't had a drink for many years. He was a little different to the other men. He wasn't as rough. He lived at home with his mother. He didn't have a lot of experience with women. But their relationship, maybe in some ways, he was a little too tame for Catherine because their relationship didn't endure very long. I mean, she got pregnant very early with him, as she did with all of the blokes. That was one way, it's a terrible thing to say, but I think of most women, but that was a way that she cemented her relationship with the men, was by having a child, because she knew if she had a child with them, they would hang around and they would support her, and that would be their responsibility. They had a child very early, a young boy, but they had a violent relationship. But I think that he may have been one of the few who actually gave back as good as he got with Catherine. It's hard to know. She had him charged once, and he was put on an AVO. But in the end, again, she up and left him. She just disappeared. She jumped trains again and started the last relationship of her life, perhaps the one she'd been building to for all those years, through Callett, Saunders and Chillingworth, when she met John Price, who was more her sort of man, I might say. He was not a violent man, Pricey, but he was a bloke's bloke, as we say down here. He drove big trucks in coal mines. He was a little guy again, nuggety, hard drinker, had a couple of children from an earlier relationship, still had a very good relationship with his first partner, who loved him dearly. Everybody loved this guy. There are stories that you would pull up. People who were passing through Aberdeen would stop at the bottom pub where he drank, meet him, and actually stay another night or two in town because they enjoyed his company so much. He was the life of the pub, a very happy, cheerful bloke. Women loved him. They wanted to mother him. He had a reasonably comfortable life. He had a small house up the road from the pub, just a, if anyone's got the book, that's his house on the front cover of the book, unremarkable house. He had shared custody of his children. His children liked him very much. So he had three children, actually. He had a son, too. And Catherine took up with him. That was a cause of much bemusement among the townsfolk, who sort of said to him, do you really know what you're getting yourself in for here? And of course he did. Everybody knew the Knight family. Everybody had heard tales about Catherine, but he was initially charmed by her, as everybody was. Charmed by her ability to have a hot meal waiting for him when he got home from the pub. Charmed by how good she was in bed. How loving she could be, but their relationship took a sour turn, as all of her relationships did.
She didn't really like the relationship he had with his former wife, Colleen, and he also didn't like the idea about the house. She always thought that he might will the house to her children. She had some ideas about that, and she really did like his job as a miner because, as you write in the book, it's about $100,000 per year. So tell us a little bit more about what her disagreement was with him over the house and Colleen.
Yeah, look, Pricey, very close to Colleen, as I said. She resented this. She was jealous of this. She made scenes about this situation. And Pricey really didn't need this grief in his life of a woman like her. It reached a point where she was more trouble than it was worth. I think he liked being a bachelor. He didn't mind the occasional meal being cooked for him, and he didn't mind sex when he got it, but I don't think he was willing, he was ready for her to move into his house, which she wanted to do. And in fact, by stealth, she did move into his house when she had a house not more than 2 kilometres away on the highway. So she had her own home, and I think at some point we should talk about her home. But she believed that she had a relationship with him, and because she had a relationship with him, his house was her house. When push came to shove and he said, listen, honey, that's your house, this is my house, let's call it quits. You know, you move back home, I'm going to stay here, it's all over. She was incensed because she had this strange sense of entitlement. And she said, well, no, this, your home is partially mine. I own half of it. She knew that he'd left it in his will to his children. She resented his children, the affection he had for them. She resented the fact that they would get the house. She resented the fact that he would not give her the house. And they squabbled for some time along these lines. And I mean, and it's completely bizarre. She has no legal right to this house at all. But in her mind, she does. And then she started to demand a sum of money to go away. And he was desperate to get rid of her, but found it difficult to make the break. And she would reappear in his life, you know, slip in the middle of the night, and you know, he would be drunk and they would have sex and it was all very good. And she'd make him breakfast in the morning and he'd go to work. And then he'd think, God, how am I going to get her out of my house again? You know, it was a very difficult situation. And he became very stressed over it and by her behavior.
Now, you talk about in the book an incredible story, because I'll get you to explain what happens after all of this, but he tells her to get out, so she takes a video camera, films a bunch of things that he has in the home. Tell us about what these things are and where she sends this video and what is the result of her sending this video to someone.
This is, again, it's a sense of... he's leaving her. He needs to be punished. So she borrows the family's video camera. She goes to the shed. And he has some old first aid kit in there that he's taken from the place where he works, the mine where he works. She videos this first aid kit and a couple of other little things. It's sort of petty theft. And sends the video to his boss. And he loses his job. A very, very good job. A very high-paid job in the coal mine. She had no qualms about doing this because he had upset her by wanting her to leave. So she got back at him. Now, that was one of her first acts of revenge towards him.
Now, of course, he loses his job, and it's not like he can just get another job that easily. This is a prime job, and it's you talk about later that the abattoir business in Aberdeen just dries up, but what remarkably happens with Pricey and the relationship with Catherine?
Well, he does get another job, and like everybody else, I don't know if he takes her back so much as he doesn't really have the strength to keep her away because she's very persistent, but he gets another job at a place called Bowditch's Earth Removals, and because he's a very good worker. You could set your watch by this fella. He was illiterate, couldn't read or write, but he ended up having quite a senior job there, and he would arrive at work 40 minutes before everybody else. He worked very hard. He was a very reliable employee, never missed a day's work in his life. But he started to get very concerned about her behaviour. She was saying, if you don't give me this money, I won't go away. She was then threatening violence against his children. He knew as well as anybody that she was capable of extreme violence. And one night, they end up having a fight. They're rolling around on the floor in front of the television, scratching and clawing and God knows what. At some point, he has grabbed her breast and bruised her breast with his fingers. At another point, she gets up, grabs a knife, and chases him out of the house with a knife. He goes to report this to the police, but unfortunately she is also gone to the police. She has photographs. She's very good at documenting any evidence, or we don't know if she made it up or what, but in this case, she had photographs taken of the finger marks on her breast as proof of the violence that he perpetrated against her. We have a thing called an AVO here. I'm not sure if you have them in America, an apprehended violence order, which you can get taken out by the police or a magistrate to have somebody kept away from you. He tried to get one taken out against her because he, by this stage, was convinced that she was going to kill him. There was some confusion, and it ended up that the AVO was served against him, not her. He'd had a very, very disturbing experience after the incident with the knife, where he had woken up and she was standing at the end of his bed, staring at him with her hands behind her back. And he knew that she had a knife behind her back, and he believed that she was possibly contemplating killing him there and then. He became so frightened about this that he told a couple of people. He took a day off work. They were very worried about him at work. He told his boss what was going on. His boss said, you can stay. There's an apartment at the earth moving business, or you can stay at my house. You can't go back to your home. He said, I have to go back. I can't. If she doesn't get me, she'll get my children. He took the day off work. He went to the magistrate to try and sort out the AVO. The magistrate said, the clerk there said, look, you know, you're going to have to come back 2 weeks. This is a difficult process. He sort of took it on the chin, had a laugh with the bloke, said, I don't know if I'm going to live that long, pal. He ran into his neighbours across the road, the Collisons. He went in there. The husband and wife, the wife there was very fond of him. He had a few drinks there that night. She could see that he was very disturbed. She said, what's going on? He told them the story of what had happened, with her being chased out of the house with the knife and then waking up with her at the end of his bed with a knife. They told him not to go home. He said, I have to. He'd also told some people in the pub that night, and he went home. The next morning, that night, they heard her car pulling up and they heard some movement around the place. They didn't think too much of it. But the next morning they woke up and they looked out, and his truck was still in the driveway. His work boots were still on the front porch, and he hadn't gone to work. They would have been more surprised if the sun hadn't come up, because he was a guy who was extremely punctual, as I said, and they became very concerned at this moment that something was wrong in the house across the road. And calls his work were ringing, trying to find out where he was. It was most unusual. Another neighbour was contacted, and people started to gather, his friends started to gather at the property to see what was going on, and they knocked on the door. There was no answer. They could hear the air conditioner ringing. And then they noticed blood around the doorstep, and I think they all knew immediately that their mate was in trouble, and they rang the police.
Now, before we talk about Detective Bob Wells, and he's a central figure in this book as well, incredible result of this crime and the effect of him seeing this crime scene, and you describe it in incredible detail. Where are the children, and what did Catherine do, which was unusual in regards to the children, this just hours before?
Yeah, so while John Price was explaining his fears to various people that evening, Catherine gathered together her daughters and took them out for a Chinese meal at the local restaurant. It was a little unusual, but she gathered them all around. And before she did something that they weren't, made some videos of herself playing with her granddaughter and blowing raspberries on its stomach and, you know, images of a normal, loving grandmother. But when she was alone in the room, she put the video camera on top of the television and sat in a chair and began to make a video of what sounds like a last will and testament. It's telling the children that they own this and they own that, and don't let anybody take, you know, it's this, again, this sense of entitlement. Don't let anyone take this off you or that off you, you know. And says, I love my children very much and I hope to see them again one day. And then somebody walks in the room and she turns off the video camera, and that's the end of that video. They go out for dinner. They separate, they go home. She goes back to her house. Earlier in the day, she's gone to a local charity shop and she's bought a black negligee, a black lacy underwear type thing. And she goes around to Price's house and she puts on this black negligee and slips into his bedroom and they have sex. We wonder what's going on in John Price's mind at this stage. He's told everybody he can in the town that he believes that Catherine's going to kill him at some point. Instead, she arrives and she walks into the bedroom and has sex with him. He has nowhere else to go. He can't run away because he's worried that she will track down his children, not her children, and kill them as she's threatened to. And she's actually accused his eldest daughter of raping her son, which is an extraordinary accusation. She's only very young herself, this girl. And from there, we know from the forensic evidence, we know from Catherine's evidence, in fact, that they have sex and that John is lying in bed, probably on his back. She goes out, she goes to the toilet, she comes back with a knife, and she proceeds to attack him in, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into. Do we have squeamish listeners?
Oh, no, we don't. We do not have any. Tell us about the stabbing, and we'll stop there. How many times does she stab him at least? And then tell us about the circumstances that he is discovered, and that will introduce Detective Bob Wells and some other police officers.
Well, we believe the first time she stabbed him, and this is with the knives from the abattoir, while he's asleep, she stabs him in the neck and severs the carotid artery, and there's a great spray of blood in the bedroom. He naturally, he wakes in fright. This hasn't killed him. He begins to flee down the hallway of the house. She chases him. She's stabbing him as he runs down the hallway. There are massive blood sprays down the hallway. Sometimes she stabs him with such violence that the knife, it's a big knife, actually passes right through his body.
Wow.
She continues to stab him. He reaches the front door. He opens the front door. He actually gets outside the house, but she pulls him back in and continues to stab him until we presume he dies. There were 37 puncture wounds between the bedroom and the front that he's suffered between the bedroom and the front door, and he bleeds to death. He dies just in the little hallway behind the front door of this brick suburban country home. But she's not finished there, and it's a murder in two parts, and it's sort of, this is perhaps what's interesting about her. The stabbing was angry. It was revenge. It was violent. It was heated. It could have passed for a murder of passion, of inflamed passion, of anger. But what she does next is what makes Catherine so fascinating. her anger sated. The fact that she's killed him, she becomes very calm. I believe the judge refers to the calmness of what she does next. She actually decides to indulge all those perverted fantasies that she's had all her life, but which she lived out at the abattoir in particular, and she goes back to work on his body. She skins him cleanly with an incision down the back, down his spine, peels the skin from his torso in one piece. The forensic evidence was that it probably weighed about 15 kilos, the skin. She hung the skin on a butcher's hook in the doorway of the lounge room. She's moved the body, by this time, into the lounge room. She decapitates him. The forensic scientists say that it was an anatomical dissection. She did it very carefully. It would have taken some time. She's not, and I suppose what I'm saying here and what the judge is saying in the forensic science is that this isn't, there's no frenzy involved anymore. The frenzy is gone. She is calm. She's collected and she's very purposeful. And at times, evidence suggests that she stops for a cigarette to sort of survey the work that she's doing. But she's not finished because she decides to make a meal from her lover. She removes the head. She puts it into a large pot with onions, vegetables, and makes a soup from the head. She removes part of his buttocks and makes meal with the meat. She cleans vegetables. She cooks marrow and pumpkin and potato. She makes gravy. And then she sets out the table with two plates with the meat, the vegetables, the gravy, and these roughly written placemats. One for his son and one for his daughter, saying, here's your dad. This is revenge because for you, to the daughter, he says, for what you did to my son, which is a complete invention, and the meals were never meant to be eaten. Those children weren't there. They were never going to come home. It was the middle of the night. And then, cutting back to when the police arrive, Catherine is in the bedroom asleep. She's had a shower. She's changed and she's in the bedroom. She's taken a token overdose of pills. Not enough to kill her. In no way would they kill her. And when they enter the crime scene, which is absolutely horrific, as you can imagine, they can hear a noise from the master bedroom, and it's Catherine snoring in bed. So they have, and this was a very calculated act by her, because she has decided, she's planned this murder. She's hinted that she would murder him and get away with it because everybody will think that I'm mad, is the phrase she uses. Because she's indulged this sick fantasy, you know, sane people don't behave like this, do they? And she hasn't tried to flee the scene. You know, she's acted as a, and she pleads that she has some sort of amnesia about what's happened, that she was glad.
Sure.
And she believes that she will get away with this crime. She doesn't need to run away.
Now, what Bob Wells finds out and what we see is that somewhere during this, the murder, the stabbing to death, and then the butchering of this person and display, this careful dissection and the cooking of him, She went to the ATM machine and took out as much money as she could in this, you know, in this very lucid mind to be able to go there and be able to go to this ATM machine and take out this money. Now, talk about Bob Wells like you do in the book. Obviously, he has this adverse, very dramatic reaction to what he sees in that house, doesn't he?
Yes, and he's not alone there. Bob's sergeant, he drives up from Newcastle that we talked about before. When he gets there, the local police are at the scene. The forensic scientists are at the scene. There are people documenting it. He arrives. They're all on the front lawn. Nobody wants to be in his house. And one of them says, "You will not believe what's in here." And he says, "Yeah, yeah." I mean, Bob's not a, and I might point out, Bob's not a homicide detective. He's not. But he's seen enough in his life. And everybody is standing on his pile. And there is not one person, not one person associated with the police who attended that crime scene who is the same person when they leave it. Many of them didn't go back to work. A forensic scientist submitted his paperwork that afternoon, drove home, and never returned, never spent another day in the police force. Almost every one of them's been diagnosed with some psychiatric reaction to what happens. And I suppose this is what makes Bob such a compelling figure, that the homicide aren't interested in the case because the woman's pled, they've got the woman straight away. It's cut and dried. He has no support. He's a lone police officer, and he's told, "You go, you do the report for the coroner. You do the report, and when it gets to trial, yeah, be cut and dried. It's all yours." But he's very concerned that she won't be convicted of murder because it looks like an act of madness. And so that's what, at some point in his investigation, he discovers that there's $1,000 being taken out of Price's bank account after he's murdered on that night. So at some stage, we presume she's had a shower, she's driven to the next town, which is about a 20-kilometre drive, she's gone to an ATM, and she's taken out $500, which to that point in time was generally about the limit of what you could take out from a teller machine. She's then 2 minutes later gone back to the teller machine and taken out another $500. This intrigues me, this act, because it suggests to me that perhaps she wasn't alone, and that perhaps another member of her family is with her and has driven her to the teller and told her that, no, you could get $1,000 out of his account. Maybe I'm reading too much into that, but there is a suggestion that somebody else was involved at this point, not at the murder. But this is critical evidence to the police, because this, and to what they present to the judge, because this proves that she's thinking very clearly. She's not a woman in some sort of psychological fog who's disassociated from her actions. Here is a woman, this is another act of revenge. You know, the defilement of the body is an act of revenge. But the stealing of money is an act of revenge, and gets to that point that I've made a few times about her sense of entitlement. She couldn't get half the house. She couldn't get the $10,000 that she was asking. She couldn't break his relationship with his first wife and children. So she killed him, but she did get $1,000. So, you know, I think that made her quite happy. We don't actually know what happened to the money either, which that's further to that theory that perhaps she dropped it off to another family member.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about Bob Wells, and how it affects him is that he's affected with post-traumatic stress disorder and nightmares and this incredible anxiety because, he figures that the prosecution will give him some kind of, give her a plea bargain. But he is, in his investigations, is finding a lot of people that have said, that she has said, "I will kill him, I'll kill the kids." So he's gathering a lot of that kind of information. But at the same time, you talk about how ridiculous it would seem to anybody like ourselves that she would be considered insane by the standards. Once she's in the hospital, she's sticking with this amnesia, and there's a doctor, the pronunciation you'll have to help me out with, but he is buying into what she is saying. So tell us a little bit about this psychiatrist for the defense that speaks to her and seems to be believing her story.
Yes, well, I mean, it's not uncommon, is it, to go psychiatrist shopping if you want a defense. I'm not sure that's exactly what happens in this situation, but he does believe her story. He believes that she has a disassociation on this night, and that this is Mr. Jafrida, that dissociative amnesia, I think it's called, and he says that she is not of right mind when she kills Price, and that insanity, you know, she can use that as a defense against a murder charge. This really upsets. Wells takes this case personally. I think Wells, in a way, identifies with Price. He can't get it out of his mind, the fear and the horror of what happened to Price that night. He particularly can't get out of his mind the crime scene. Every time he closes his eyes, he sees the crime scene. He's a man in a terrible psychological trauma after that. The more he researches the case, the more he becomes convinced that it follows the narrative that I've given you, because very much I followed in Bob's footsteps. That she was a woman, a violent, evil woman, that she planned to kill her husband because she told a family member that one, she'd kill him and get away with it, and the family member told that to Bob Wells. That was a critical piece of evidence. And he really felt like he had to do the right thing by John Price and make sure that this woman was convicted of murder and didn't get away with it, just as she got away with her violence for her whole life. And it became a quest for Bob. He was suffering from... he wasn't very healthy at all at the time. I've forgotten the word that she said. When you get... had a very sore foot. Sorry, I forgot the name of this disease.
Gout.
Thank you. he was walking without a shoe on. He was driving here. He was driving there. He'd become quite manic. I spent a lot of time with him and his wife at the time after the murder. And I had a conversation with her a few years ago because eventually their marriage broke down. And she said to me, you know, Pete, Bobby never came home that day. She said, that man that you know now wasn't the man that left for work that day. He was forever changed by what he saw and haunted by it. You know, she still had a lot of affection for him. But that scene, and this is not uncommon with police officers to have post-traumatic stress disorder, and it's, you know, it is one event that will tip them over the edge, but it's a compilation of things that they've endured through their careers. And, you know, Bob told me stories of the terrible road accidents that he'd attended on country roads where he'd sat holding a victim's, you know, skull together for an hour waiting for an ambulance to come and being chased by men with knives. I mean, it wasn't just this crime that had got to Bob, but it was this crime that tipped him over the edge, and he ended up needing a lot of psychiatric help, actually.
Now, the prosecution gets a Dr. Robert Delaforce, and Delaforce has a different diagnosis after speaking with her for almost 9 hours. What is his conclusions regarding her mental illness or lack of?
Well, he basically says, yes, she is a woman who suffers from borderline personality disorder. But what she did that night was not an expression of her disease. It was an expression of her personality. He says she enjoyed what she did. It was, she lived out a fantasy, and they found horror videos in the house, and there was one. I watched it back in the day. It's called Resurrection, where a serial killer goes around and hangs people on butcher's hooks and dismembers them. And Dalaforce believed that there were some, there was some correlation with the crime there, with the butcher's hook and the skin hanging on the from the butcher's hook. He basically said she knew exactly what she was doing and she was having a very good time. He believed that she'd actually planned it for months. She dreamt of killing him. And one of the keys to Catherine was the, that I mentioned earlier, she owned her own home. It was an old weatherboard, it was a shopfront on the highway, nothing fancy. But she loved her home, as most people will. And she didn't love her home because she planted flowers and had birds in cages and there were doilies and, you know, pretty pictures on the wall. She loved her home because she felt calm there. And why she felt calm? She had decorated almost every surface inch of the living area with dead things, with things that were related to death. There were skulls, there were pelts, there were horns, there were knives. It was, as Dalaforce says, a place of death and destruction. This was how she decorated the place where she felt the safest. She said, you know, this was a place where I felt calm, sitting among, like, there were stuffed animals. She found some, it was almost like a necrophilia. She was comforted by death and by being around death. And by killing things, by seeing living things become dead things. And that's why she enjoyed so much that defilement of John Price's body on the night. That's why she did it. But it had a double purpose, it had a dual purpose. She fulfilled the fantasy. And at the same time, she's a very cunning woman, she was constructing a defense for herself.
Now, in terms of her imprisonment, what does she tell people about her imprisonment? What does she, does she like it or hate it?
I get, she's not open to discussing her imprisonment with me. She's quite hostile toward me. I hear various stories. Some people, some prisoners, report that she is the victim of a history of domestic violence and abuse, that she snapped and that she killed this man because she was a victim herself and she was protecting herself. And this is a story that she has woven for herself and for members of her family, if they want to accept that story and get along with her. There are others there who I have some communication with, some of the guards who looked after her, and they tell me that she is a dangerous, frightening woman who does appear calm, who at one point she was very keen. I mean, she made her own clothes. She was very, you know, she was a dressmaker of sorts, an amateur dressmaker. She made very sexy outfits for herself. She was very fond of short skirts and hot pants, and she was a very sexual woman. And she's very into craft in the prison, but they've had to be very wary of what tools she uses because they do not trust her in the prison system. Somebody obtained for me some paintings that she'd done, which at first glance are not very remarkable. She paints clowns. But if you look very carefully, very, very disturbing clowns. These are evil clowns. They have, she's quite skillful. These bloodshot eyes, these evil eyes set into a sort of normal clown face. There's a series of these paintings. They look like something out of a horror movie. But very, very disturbing.
We've only got a few minutes, but I wanted to make sure that we spoke about at the trial, as you talk about in the book, Dr. Guifreda, they don't really even call him as a witness to defense. You have Delaforce, and you also have the defense, the prosecution brings in another psychiatrist, which goes even further than Delaforce does and says that there is no personality disorder, and basically she knew what she was doing and maybe even enjoyed it. What was Catherine Knight's demeanor at trial? At the sentencing, I should say, because she pleaded guilty, so...
Well, actually, just to establish it, she pled not guilty, and a trial started. But once the evidence started to be presented in the court case, and once she was, confronted with what she did, she called off the trial, she changed, and she pled guilty. At this stage, Justice O'Keefe was very concerned that she might not be doing the right thing, and... He consulted with her lawyers and said, we need to take a break for a few days, see if your client really does want to plead guilty. And she pled guilty. And we believe she pled guilty because she did not want to be confronted by the evidence of what she did. At one point where she seemed absolutely fascinated by the psychologist's evidence and their accounts of what happened to her and her life, of her childhood. She wet the bed as a child because she lived in fear of the dark. I mean, she was a traumatized child, and how that led to the borderline personality disorder and what was going on when she put Melissa on the train tracks. She was fascinated by this evidence. But when evidence of the crime was presented and they played the crime scene video to a closed court, she began to scream hysterically and have a fit and throw herself about. And that happened on at least one occasion. And she had to be removed from the court. But the fit passed very quickly when she was given a cup of tea with sugar in it. And she calmed down. And O'Keefe really wasn't buying this from Catherine and said, it's put on. I don't care how she carries on. She's sitting there. We're getting through this. The crime scene video, which I've seen, is the most horrific video you've ever seen in your life. I know you can imagine a skinned torso, the skin. At one point, the forensic detective takes the lid off the pot on the stove, and John Price's head is looking. John Price is looking up at you. His head there. His eyes staring at the camera. This goes on, and she's found guilty. She is given a sentence never to be released. We don't have the death sentence in Australia. She has appealed against this on two occasions. The appeal's been rejected, so she's going to spend the rest of her life in jail. In a funny way, as you asked earlier, she finds jail a little bit comforting because of the routines and the strangely enough, the security of it all. Her life's ordered and organized, but there's no doubt she also thinks that she was a victim protecting herself from a violent man, from a string of violent men. And poor old Price was the one who paid for all those who came before him.
Yes. Well, you've captured it all in this amazing book, Bloodstain. I want to thank you very much, Peter, for coming on and talking about this true story of Catherine Knight. For those that may want to contact you or find out more information about other work that you have done, do you do Facebook or do you have a website?
Facebook, and they can find me there. But this was my one and only true crime book. I have done a lot of books, but this was the only one for true crime fans.
Right. Well,
I think once was enough.
Yeah, I was going to say, you wouldn't be too eager to do another one. I mean, God, you might end up like Bob Wells. So, yeah, incredible. I want to thank you very much, Peter, for coming on and talking about incredible tale. And thank you very much, and have a great day. Thank you.
I want to say it was a pleasure, but it was very kind of you to have me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peter. Good night.